now to actually talk about it. It seems a stupid reason to throw away what we had, but that's why. And as more time passed, I just didn't know how to go about fixing it. He was still silent. She stared at the framed caricature of DK that hung on her wall, DK's ears comically pointed, and wondered what Obinze was feeling. Finally, he said, "I can't imagine how bad you must have felt, and how alone. You should have told me. I so wish you had told me." She heard his words like a melody, and she felt herself breathing unevenly, gulping at the air. She would not cry. It was ridiculous to cry after so long, but her eyes were filling with tears, and there was a boulder in her chest and a stinging in her throat. The tears felt itchy. She made no sound. He took her hand in his, both clasped on the table, and between them silence grew, an ancient silence that they both knew. She was inside this silence, and she was safe. Chapter 52. "Let's go and play table tennis. I belong to this small private club in Victoria Island," he said. "I haven't played in ages." She remembered how she had always wanted to beat him, even though he was the school champion, and how he would tell her teasingly, "Try more strategy and less force. Passion never wins any game, never mind what they say." He said something similar now. "Excuses don't win a game. You should try strategy." He had driven himself. In the car, he turned the engine on, and the music came on too. Brackets, Yori Yori. "Oh, I love this song," she said. He increased the volume and they sang along. There was an exuberance to the song, its rhythmic joyfulness, so free of artifice that filled the air with lightness. "Uh-uh. How long have you been back and you can already sing this so well?" he asked. "First thing I did was brush up on the contemporary music. It's so exciting, all the new music." "It is. Now clubs play Nigerian music." She would remember this moment, sitting beside Obinze in his Range Rover, stalled in traffic, listening to "Yori Yori, your love they make my heart do, Yori Yori, nobody can love you the way I do." Beside them a shiny Honda, the latest model, and in front of them an ancient Datsun that looked 100 years old. After a few games of table tennis, all of which he won, all the time playfully taunting her, they had lunch in the small restaurant, where they were alone except for a woman reading newspapers at the bar. The manager, a round man who was almost bursting out of his ill-fitting black jacket, came over to their table often to say, "I hope everything is fine, sir. It is very good to see you again, sir. How is work, sir?" Ifemelu leaned in and asked Obinze, "Is there a point at which you gag?" "The man wouldn't come by so often if he didn't think I was being neglected. You're addicted to that phone." "Sorry, I was just checking the blog." She felt relaxed and happy. "You know, you should write for me."
"Me?"
"Yes, I'll give you an assignment. How about the perils of being young and good-looking and rich?"
"I would be happy to write on a subject with which I can personally identify."
"How about security?"
"I want to do something on security. Have you had any experience on Third Mainland Bridge?"
"Somebody was telling me about leaving a club late and going back to the mainland and their car tire burst on the bridge and they just kept going because it's so dangerous to stop on the bridge."
"Ifem, I live in Lekki and I don't go clubbing. Not anymore."
"Okay." She glanced at her phone again. "I just want to have new, vibrant content often."
"You're distracted.
Do you know Tunde Razak?"
"Who doesn't? Why?"
"I want to interview him. I want to start this weekly feature of Lagos from an insider. And I want to start with the most interesting people."
"What's interesting about him?"
"That he is a Lagos playboy, living off his father's money.
Said money accumulated from a diesel importation monopoly that they have because of their contact with the president.
He's also a music producer. And apparently a champion at chess. My friend Zemaye knows him,
and he's just written to her to say he will do the interview only if I let him buy me dinner. He's probably seen a picture of you somewhere.
Obinze stood up and pushed back his chair with a force that surprised her.
The guy is a dog.
Be nice, she said, amused. His jealousy pleased her. He played Yori Yori again on the drive back to her flat, and she swayed and danced with her arms, much to his amusement.
I thought your chapman was non-alcoholic, he said. I want to play another song. It makes me think of you.
Obi-Wan's Obi-Wan started, and she sat still and silent as the words filled the car. This is that feeling that I've never felt, and I'm not going to let it die. When the male and female voices sang in Igbo, Obinze sang along with them, glancing away from the road to look at her, as though he was telling her that this was really their conversation, he calling her beautiful, she calling him beautiful, both calling each other their true friends. Wanyo ma, nwoke o ma, umalicha nwa, eziboimo. When he dropped her off, he leaned across to kiss her cheek, hesitant to come too close or to hold her, as though afraid of being defeated by their attraction.
Can I see you tomorrow?
He asked, and she said yes. They went to a Brazilian restaurant by the lagoon, where the waiter brought skewer after skewer stacked with meat and seafood, until Ifemelu told him that she was about to be sick. The next day he asked if she would have dinner with him, and he took her to an Italian restaurant, whose overpriced food she found bland, and the bow-tied waiters, doleful and slow-moving, filled her with faint sorrow. They drove past Obalande on the way back, tables and stalls lining the bustling road, orange flames flickering from the hawkers' lamps. Ifemelu said, "Let's stop and buy fried plantain." Obinze found a spot farther ahead, in front of a beer parlor, and he eased the car in. He greeted the men seated on benches drinking, his manner easy and warm. They hailed him, "Chief, Garigo, your car is safe." The fried plantain hawker tried to persuade Ifemelu to buy fried sweet potatoes as well. No, only plantain.
What about akara, auntie? I make am now, very fresh.
Okay, Ifemelu said, put four.
Why are you buying akara that you don't want?
Obinze asked, amused. Because this is real enterprise. She's selling what she makes. She's not selling her location or the source of her oil or the name of the person that ground the beans. She's simply selling what she makes. Back in the car, she opened the oily plastic bag of plantains, slid a small, perfectly fried yellow slice into her mouth. This is so much better than that thing drenched in butter that I could hardly finish at the restaurant. And you know we can't get food poisoning because the frying kills the germs, she added. He was watching her, smiling, and she suspected that she was talking too much. This memory, too, she would store, of Obalande at night, lit as it was by 100 small lights, the raised voices of drunk men nearby, and the sway of a large madam's hips walking past the car. He asked if he could take her to lunch, and she suggested a new casual place she had heard of, where she ordered a chicken sandwich and then complained about the man smoking in the corner.
How very American, complaining about smoke, Obinze said,
and she could not tell whether he meant it as a rebuke or not. The sandwich comes with chips, Ifemelu asked the waiter.
Yes, madame. Do you have real potatoes?
Madame,
are your potatoes the frozen imported ones, or do you cut and fry your potatoes?
The waiter looked offended. It is the imported frozen ones.
As the waiter walked away, Ifemelu said, those frozen things taste horrible.
He can't believe you're actually asking for real potatoes,
Obinze said dryly.
Real potatoes are backward for him.
Remember, this is our newly middle-class world. We haven't completed the first cycle of prosperity before going back to the beginning again to drink milk from the cow's udder. Each time he dropped her off, he kissed her on the cheek, both of them leaning towards each other, and then pulling back so that she could say, bye, and climb out of his car. On the fifth day, as he drove into her compound, she asked, do you have any condoms in your pocket? He said nothing for a while.
No, I don't have any condoms in my pocket.
Well, I bought a pack some days ago.
Ifem,
Why are you saying this? You're married with a child, and we are hot for each other. Who are we kidding with this chaste dating business? So we might as well get it over with.
You are hiding behind sarcasm.
He said, Oh, how very lofty of you. She was angry. It was barely a week since she first saw him, but already she was angry. Furious that he could drop her off and go home to his other life, his real life, and that she could not visualize the details of that life, did not know what kind of bed he slept in, what kind of plate he ate from. She had, since she began to gaze at her past, imagined a relationship with him, but only in faded images and faint lines. Now, faced with the reality of him, and of the silver ring on his finger, she was frightened of becoming used to him, of drowning. Or perhaps she was already drowned, and her fear came from that knowledge.
Why didn't you call me when you came back?
He asked. I don't know. I wanted to settle down first.
I hoped I would help you settle down.
She said nothing.
Are you still with Blaine?
What does it matter, married man, you? She said, with an irony that sounded far too caustic. She wanted to be cool, distant, in control.
Can I come in for a bit, to talk?
No, I need to do some research for the blog.
Please, Yvonne.
She sighed. Okay. In her flat, he sat on the couch while she sat on her armchair, as far from him as possible. She had a sudden bilious terror about whatever it was he was going to say, which she did not want to hear, and so she said wildly, Zemaye wants to write a tongue-in-cheek guide for men who want to cheat. She said her boyfriend was unreachable the other day, and when he finally turned up, he told her that his phone had fallen into water. She said it's the oldest story in the book, Phone Fell Into Water. I thought that was funny. I've never heard that before, so number one on her guide is never say, Your phone fell into water.
This doesn't feel like cheating to me,
he said quietly. Does your wife know you're here? She was taunting him. I wonder how many men say that when they cheat, that it doesn't feel like cheating. I mean, would they actually ever say that it felt like cheating? He got up, his movements deliberate, and at first she thought he was coming closer to her, or perhaps wanted the toilet, but he walked to the front door, opened it, and left. She stared at the door. She sat still for a long time, and then she got up and paced, unable to focus, wondering whether to call him, debating with herself. She decided not to call him. She resented his behavior, his silence, his pretense. When her doorbell rang minutes later, a part of her was reluctant to open the door. She let him in. They sat side by side on her couch.
Sorry I left like that, he said. I just haven't been myself since you came back. And I didn't like the way you talked, as if what we have is common.
It isn't. And I think you know that.
I think you were saying that to hurt me, but mostly because you feel confused. I know it must be difficult for you, how we've seen each other and talked about so much, but still avoided so much.
You're speaking in code, she said. He looked stressed, tight-jawed, and she longed to kiss him. It was true that he was intelligent and sure of himself, but there was an innocence about him too, a confidence without ego, a throwback to another time and place, which she found endearing.
I haven't said anything because sometimes I'm just so happy being with you that I don't want to spoil it,
he said.
And also because I want to have something to say first before I say anything.
I touch myself thinking of you, she said. He stared at her, thrown slightly off balance. We're not single people who are courting ceiling, she said. We can't deny the attraction between us. And maybe we should have a conversation about that.
You know this isn't about sex, he said. This has never been about sex.
I know, she said, and took his hand. There was between them a weightless, seamless desire. She leaned in and kissed him, and at first he was slow in his response. And then he was pulling up her blouse, pushing down her bra cups to free her breasts. She remembered clearly the firmness of his embrace, and yet there was also a newness to their union. Their bodies remembered and did not remember. She touched the scar on his chest, remembering it again. She had always thought the expression, making love, a little maudlin. Having sex felt truer, and fucking was more arousing. But lying next to him afterwards, both of them smiling, sometimes laughing, her body suffused with peace, she thought how apt it was, that expression, making love. There was an awakening even in her nails, in those parts of her body that had always been numb. She wanted to tell him, "There is no week that passed that I did not think of you." But was that true? Of course there were weeks during which he was folded under layers of her life, but it felt true. She propped herself up and said, "I always saw the ceiling with other men." He smiled a long, slow smile.
"You know what I have felt for so long, as if I was waiting to be happy."
He got up to go to the bathroom. She found it so attractive, his shortness, his solid, firm shortness. She saw in his shortness a groundedness. He could weather anything. He would not easily be swayed. He came back and she said she was hungry, and he found oranges in her fridge and peeled them, and they ate the oranges, sitting up next to each other, and then they lay entwined, naked, in a full circle of completeness, and she fell asleep, and did not know when he left. She woke up to a dark, overcast, rainy morning. Her phone was ringing. It was Obinze.
"How are you?"
he asked. "Groggy. Not sure what happened yesterday. Did you seduce me?"
"I'm glad your door has a deadbolt. I would have hated to wake you up to lock the door."
"So you did seduce me?" He laughed.
"Can I come to you?"
She liked the way he said,
"Can I come to you?"
"Yes. It's raining crazily."
"Really? It's not raining here. I'm in Lekki."
She found this foolishly exciting, that it was raining where she was, and it was not raining where he was, only minutes from her. And so she waited with impatience, with a charged delight, until they could both see the rain together. Chapter 53. And so began her heady days full of cliché. She felt fully alive. Her heart beat faster when he arrived at her door, and she viewed each morning like the unwrapping of a gift. She would laugh, or cross her legs, or slightly sway her hips, with a heightened awareness of herself. Her nightshirt smelled of his cologne, a muted citrus and wood scent, because she left it unwashed for as long as she could. And she delayed in wiping off a spill of hand cream he had left on her sink, and after they made love, she left untouched the indentation on the pillow, the soft groove where his head had lain, as though to preserve his essence until the next time. They often stood on her veranda and watched the peacocks on the roof of the abandoned house, from time to time slipping their hands into each other's, and she would think of the next time, and the next, that they would do this together. This was love, to be eager for tomorrow. Had she felt this way as a teenager? The emotion seemed absurd. She fretted when he did not respond to her text right away. Her mind was darkened with jealousy about his past.
"You are the great love of my life," he told her.
And she believed him, but still was jealous of those women whom he had loved, even if fleetingly, those women who had carved out space in his thoughts. She was jealous even of the women who liked him, imagining how much attention he got here in Lagos, good-looking as he was, and now also wealthy. The first time she introduced him to Zamaye, listen Zamaye in her tight skirt and platform heels, she stifled her discomfort, because she saw in Zamaye's alert appreciative eyes the eyes of all the hungry women in Lagos. It was a jealousy of her imagination. He did nothing to aid it. He was present and transparent in his devotion. She marveled at what an intense, careful listener he was. He remembered everything she told him. She had never had this before, to be listened to be truly heard. And so he became newly precious. Each time he said bye at the end of a telephone call, she felt a sinking panic. It was truly absurd. Their teenage love had been less melodramatic, or perhaps it was because the circumstances were different, and looming over them now was the marriage he never talked about. Sometimes he said, "I can't come on Sunday until mid-afternoon," or "I have to leave early today," all of which she knew were about his wife, but they did not talk further about it. He did not try to, and she did not want to. Or she told herself that she did not want to. It surprised her that he took her out openly, to lunch and to dinner, to his private club where the waiter called her Madame, perhaps assuming she was his wife, that he stayed with her until past midnight and never showered after they made love, that he went home wearing her touch and her smell on his skin. He was determined to give their relationship as much dignity as he could, to pretend that he was not hiding, even though he, of course, was. Once, he said cryptically, as they lay entwined on her bed in the undecided light of late evening, "I can stay the night. I would like to stay." She said a quick no, and nothing else. She did not want to get used to waking up beside him, did not permit herself to think of why he could stay this night. And so his marriage hung above them, unspoken, unprobed, until one evening when she did not feel like eating out. He said eagerly, "You have spaghetti and onions. Let me cook for you." "As long as it doesn't give me a stomachache." He laughed. "I miss cooking. I can't cook at home." And in that instant, his wife became a dark, spectral presence in the room. It was palpable and menacing in a way it had never been when he said, "I can't come on Sunday until mid-afternoon," or "I have to leave early today." She turned away from him and flipped open her laptop to check on the blog. A furnace had lit itself deep inside her. He sensed it too, the sudden import of his words, because he came and stood beside her.
"Kusi never liked the idea of my cooking. She has really basic, mainstream ideas of what a wife should be, and she thought my wanting to cook was an indictment of her, which I found silly. So I stopped, just to have peace. I make omelettes, but that's it. And we both pretend as if my onubu soup isn't better than hers."
"There's a lot of pretending in my marriage, Ifem." He paused.
"I married her when I was feeling vulnerable. I had a lot of upheaval in my life at the time."
She said, her back turned to him, "Obinze, please just cook this spaghetti.
I feel a great responsibility for Kusi, and that is all I feel, and I want you to know that."
He gently turned her around to face him, holding her shoulders, and he looked as if there were other things he wanted to say, but expected her to help him say them. And for this she felt the flare of a new resentment. She turned back to her laptop, choked with the urge to destroy, to slash and burn. "I'm having dinner with Tunde Razak tomorrow," she said.
"Why?"
"Because I want to."
"You said the other day that you wouldn't."
"What happens when you go home and climb into bed with your wife? What happens?" she asked, and felt herself wanting to cry. Something had cracked and spoilt between them. "I think you should go," she said.
"No."
"Obinze, please just go." He refused to leave. And later she felt grateful that he had not left. He cooked spaghetti, and she pushed it around her plate, her throat parched, her appetite gone.
"I'm never going to ask you for anything. I'm a grown woman, and I knew your situation when I got into this," she said. "Please don't say that," he said. "It scares me. It makes me feel dispensable."
"It's not about you."
"I know. I know it's the only way you can feel a little dignity in this."
She looked at him, and even his reasonableness began to irritate her.
"I love you, Ifem. We love each other," he said.
There were tears in his eyes. She began to cry too, a helpless crying, and they held each other. Later they lay in bed together, and the air was so still and noiseless that the gurgling sound from his stomach seemed loud.
"Was that my stomach or yours?"
he asked, teasing. "Of course it was yours."
"Remember the first time we made love?
You had just been standing on me.
I loved you standing on me.
I can't stand on you now. I'm too fat. You would die.
Stop it."
Finally, he got up and pulled on his trousers, his movement slow and reluctant.
"I can't come tomorrow, Efem. I have to take my daughter."
She cut him short. "It's okay."
"I'm going to Abuja on Friday,"
he said. "Yes, you said." She was trying to push away the sense of a coming abandonment. It would overwhelm her as soon as he left, and she heard the click of the door closing.
"Come with me,"
he said. "What?"
"Come with me to Abuja. I just have two meetings, and we can stay the weekend. It'll be good for us to be in a different place to talk, and you've never been to Abuja. I can book separate hotel rooms if you want me to." "Say yes, please."
"Yes," she said. She had not permitted herself to do so earlier, but after he left, she looked at Kusi's photographs on Facebook. Kusi's beauty was startling. Those cheekbones, that flawless skin, those perfect womanly curves. When she saw one photo taken at an unflattering angle, she examined it for a while and found in it a small and wicked pleasure. She was at the hair salon when he sent her a text.
"I'm sorry, Efem, but I think I should probably go alone to Abuja. I need some time to think things through. I love you."
She stared at the text, and fingers shaking, she wrote him back a two-word text. "Fucking coward." Then she turned to the hair braider. "You are going to blow-dry my hair with that brush? You must be joking. Can't you people think?" The hair braider looked puzzled. "Auntie, sorry, but that is what I used before in your hair." By the time Ifemelu drove into her compound, Obinze's Range Rover was parked in front of her flat. He followed her upstairs.
"Efem, I want you to understand. I think it has been a little too fast, everything between us, and I want to take some time to put things in perspective."
"A little too fast," she repeated. "How unoriginal. Not like you at all."
"You are the woman I love. Nothing can change that. But I feel this sense of responsibility about what I need to do."
She flinched from him, the hoarseness of his voice, the nebulous and easy meaninglessness of his words. What did responsibility about what I need to do mean? Did it mean that he wanted to continue seeing her but had to stay married? Did it mean that he could no longer continue seeing her? He communicated clearly when he wanted to, but now here he was, hiding behind watery words. "What are you saying?" she asked him. "What are you trying to tell me?" When he remained silent, she said, "Go to hell." She walked into her bedroom and locked the door. From her bedroom window, she watched his Range Rover until it disappeared down the bend in the road. Chapter 54. Abuja had far-flung horizons, wide roads, order. To come from Lagos was to be stunned here by sequence and space. The air smelled of power. Here everyone sized everyone else up, wondering how much of a somebody each was. It smelled of money, easy money, easily exchanged money. It dripped, too, of sex. Obinze's friend Chidi said he didn't chase women in Abuja because he didn't want to step on a minister's or senator's toes. Every attractive young woman here became mysteriously suspect. Abuja was more conservative than Lagos, Chidi said, because it was more Muslim than Lagos, and at parties women didn't wear revealing clothing, yet you could buy and sell sex so much more easily here. It was in Abuja that Obinze had come close to cheating on Kosi, not with any of the flashy girls in coloured contact lenses and tumbling hair weaves who endlessly propositioned him, but with a middle-aged woman in a caftan who sat next to him at the hotel bar and said, "I know you are bored." She looked hungry for recklessness, perhaps a repressed, frustrated wife who had broken free on this one night. For a moment, lust, a quaking, raw lust, overcame him. But he thought about how much more bored he would be afterwards, how keen to get her out of his hotel room, and it all seemed too much of an effort. She would end up with one of the many men in Abuja who lived idle, oily lives in hotels and part-time homes, grovelling and courting connected people so as to get a contract or to be paid for a contract. On Obinze's last trip to Abuja, one such man, whom he hardly knew, had looked for a while at two young women at the other end of the bar, and then asked him casually, "Do you have a spare condom?" And he had balked. Now, sitting at a white-covered table in Proti Asokoro, waiting for Edusko, the businessman who wanted to buy his land, he imagined Ifemeru next to him, and wondered what she would make of Abuja. She would dislike it, the soullessness of it. Or perhaps not. She was not easy to predict. Once, at dinner in a restaurant in Victoria Island, somber waiters hovering around, she had seemed distant, her eyes on the wall behind him, and he had worried that she was upset about something.
"What are you thinking?" he asked.
"I am thinking of how all the paintings in Lagos always look crooked, never hung straight," she said. He laughed, and thought how with her he was as he had never been with another woman, amused, alert, alive. Later, as they left the restaurant, he had watched as she briskly sidestepped the puddles of water in the potholes by the gate, and felt a desire to smooth all the roads in Lagos for her. His mind was overwrought. One minute he thought it was the right decision not to have come to Abuja with her, because he needed to think things through, and the next he was filled with self-reproach. He might have pushed her away. He had called her many times, sent texts asking if they could talk, but she had ignored him, which was perhaps for the better, because he did not know what he would say if they did talk. Edusko had arrived, a loud voice bellowing from the restaurant foyer as he spoke on the phone. Obinze did not know him well. They had done business only once before, introduced by a mutual friend, but Obinze admired men like him, men who did not know any big man, who had no connections, and had made their money in a way that did not defy the simple logic of capitalism. Edusko had only a primary school education before he began to apprentice for traders. He started off with one stall in Onitsha, and now owned the second largest transport company in the country. He walked into the restaurant, bold-stepped and big-bellied, speaking his terrible English loudly. It did not occur to him to doubt himself. Later, as they discussed the price of the land, Edusko said,
"Look, my brother, you won't sell it at that price. Nobody will buy. Ife isika kita. The recession is biting everybody."
"Bros, bring up your hand a little. This is land in Matama we are talking about, not land in your village."
Obinze said,
"Your stomach is full. What else do you want? You see, this is the problem with you Igbo people. You don't do brother-brother. That is why I like Yoruba people. They look out for one another. Do you know that the other day I went to the Inland Revenue Office near my house, and one man there, an Igbo man, I saw his name and spoke to him in Igbo, and he did not even answer me. A Hausa man will speak Hausa to his fellow Hausa man. A Yoruba man will see a Yoruba person anywhere and speak Yoruba, but an Igbo man will speak English to an Igbo man. I'm even surprised that you are speaking Igbo to me."
"It's true," Obinze said. "It's sad. It's the legacy of being a defeated people. We lost the Biafran war and learned to be ashamed."
"It is just selfishness,"
Edusko said, uninterested in Obinze's intellectualizing.
"The Yoruba man is there helping his brother. But you Igbo people, Igasikwa, look at you now, quoting me this price."
"Okay, Edusko, why don't I give you the land for free? Let me go and bring the title and give it to you now."
Edusko laughed. Edusko liked him, he could tell. He imagined Edusko talking about him in a gathering of other self-made Igbo men, men who were brash and striving, who juggled huge businesses and supported vast extended families.
Obinze Maife,
he imagined Edusko saying.
Obinze is not like some of these useless small boys with money. This one is not stupid.
Obinze looked at his almost empty bottle of Gilda. It was strange how lost of luster everything was without Ifemelu. Even the taste of his favourite beer was different. He should have brought her with him to Abuja. It was stupid to claim that he needed time to think things over, when all he was doing was hiding from a truth he already knew. She had called him a coward, and there was indeed a cowardliness in his fear of disorder, of disrupting what he did not even want. His life with Kosi, that second skin that had never quite fitted him snugly.
Okay, Edusko,
Obinze said, suddenly feeling drained.
I'm not going to eat the land if I don't sell it.
Edusko looked startled.
You mean you agreed to my price?
Yes, Obinze said. After Edusko left, Obinze called Ifemelu over and over, but she did not answer. Perhaps her ringer was switched off, and she was eating at her dining table, wearing that pink T-shirt she wore so often, with a small hole at the neck, and Heartbreaker Cafe written across the front. Her nipples, when they got hard, would punctuate those words like inverted commas. Thinking of her pink T-shirt aroused him. Or perhaps she was reading in bed, her abada wrapper spread over her like a blanket, wearing plain black boy shorts and nothing else. All her underwear was plain black boy shorts. Girly underwear amused her. Once he had picked up those boy shorts from the floor where he had flung them after rolling them down her legs, and looked at the milky crust on the crotch, and she laughed and said, "Ah, you want to smell it? Have never understood that whole business of smelling underwear." Or perhaps she was on her laptop, working on the blog, or out with Rani Nudo, or on the phone with DK, or perhaps with some man in her living room, telling him about Graham Greene. A queasiness roiled in him at the thought of her with anybody else. Of course she would not be with anybody else. Not so soon. Still, there was that unpredictable stubbornness in her. She might do it to hurt him. When she told him that first day, "I always saw the ceiling with other men," he wondered how many there had been. He wanted to ask her, but he did not, because he feared she would tell him the truth, and he feared he would forever be tormented by it. She knew, of course, that he loved her, but he wondered if she knew how it consumed him, how each day was infected by her, affected by her, and how she wielded power over even his sleep. Kimberly adores her husband, and her husband adores himself. She should leave him, but she never will, she said once, about the woman she had worked for in America, the woman with Obiocha. Ifemelu's words had been light, free of shadow, and yet he heard in them the sting of other meanings. When she told him about her American life, he listened with a keenness close to desperation. He wanted to be a part of everything she had done, be familiar with every emotion she had felt. Once she had told him, "The thing about cross-cultural relationships is that you spend so much time explaining. My ex-boyfriends and I spent a lot of time explaining. I sometimes wondered whether we would even have anything at all to say to each other if we were from the same place." And it pleased him to hear that, because it gave his relationship with her a depth, a lack of trifling novelty. They were from the same place, and they still had a lot to say to each other. They were talking about American politics once when she said, "I like America. It's really the only place else where I could live apart from here. But one day a bunch of Blaine's friends and I were talking about kids, and I realized that if I ever have children, I don't want them to have American childhoods. I don't want them to say hi to adults. I want them to say good morning and good afternoon. I don't want them to mumble good when someone says how are you to them, or to raise five fingers when asked how old they are. I want them to say I'm fine, thank you, and I'm 5 years old. I don't want a child who feeds on praise and expects a star for effort, and talks back to adults in the name of self-expression." Is that terribly conservative? Blaine's friend said it was, and for them, conservative is the worst insult you can get. He had laughed, wishing he had been there with a bunch of friends, and he wanted that imaginary child to be his, that conservative child with good manners. He told her,
the child would turn 18 and paint her hair purple.
And she said, yes, but by then I would have kicked her out of the house. At the Abuja airport on his way back to Lagos, he thought of going to the international wing instead, buying a ticket to somewhere improbable like Malabo. Then he felt a passing self-disgust, because he would not, of course, do it. He would instead do what he was expected to do. He was boarding his Lagos flight when Kosi called. Is the flight on time? Remember we are taking Nigel out for his birthday, she said.
Of course I remember.
A pause from her end. He had snapped.
I'm sorry, he said. I have a funny headache.
Darling, Ndo, I know you're tired, she said. See you soon. He hung up and thought about the day their baby, slippery, curly-haired Buki, was born at the Woodlands Hospital in Houston. How Kosi had turned to him while he was still fiddling with his latex gloves and said with something like apology,
Darling, we'll have a boy next time.
He had recoiled. He realized then that she did not know him. She did not know him at all. She did not know he was indifferent about the gender of their child, and he felt a gentle contempt towards her for wanting a boy because they were supposed to want a boy, and for being able to say, fresh from birthing their first child, those words, we'll have a boy next time. Perhaps he should have talked more with her, about the baby they were expecting, and about everything else, because although they exchanged pleasant sounds and were good friends and shared comfortable silences, they did not really talk. But he had never tried, because he knew that the questions he asked of life were entirely different from hers. He knew this from the beginning, had sensed it in their first conversation after a friend introduced them at a wedding. She was wearing a satin bridesmaid's dress in fuchsia, cut low to show a cleavage he could not stop looking at, and somebody was making a speech, describing the bride as a woman of virtue, and Kosi nodded eagerly and whispered to him,
she's a true woman of virtue.
It surprised him that she could use the word virtue without the slightest irony, as was done in the badly written articles in the women's section of the weekend newspapers. The minister's wife is a homely woman of virtue. Still, he had wanted her, chased her with a lavish single-mindedness. He had never seen a woman with such a perfect incline to her cheekbones that made her entire face seem so alive, so architectural, lifting when she smiled. He was also newly rich, and newly disoriented. One week he was broke and squatting in his cousin's flat, and the next he had millions of naira in his bank account. Kosi became a touchstone of realness. If he could be with her, so extraordinarily beautiful, and yet so ordinary, predictable, and domestic and dedicated, then perhaps his life would start to seem believably his. She moved into his house from the flat she shared with a friend and arranged her perfume bottles on his dresser, citrusy scents that he came to associate with home, and she sat in the BMW beside him, as though it had always been his car, and she casually suggested trips abroad, as though he had always been able to travel, and when they showered together, she scrubbed him with a rough sponge, even between his toes, until he felt reborn, until he owned his new life. She did not share his interests. She was a literal person who did not read. She was content rather than curious about the world, but he felt grateful to her, fortunate to be with her. Then she told him her relatives were asking what his intentions were. They just keep asking, she said, and stressed the they to exclude herself from the marriage clamour. He recognized and disliked her manipulation. Still, he married her. They were living together anyway, and he was not unhappy, and he imagined that she would, with time, gain a certain heft. She had not, after 4 years, except physically, in a way that he thought made her look even more beautiful, fresher, with fuller hips and breasts, like a well-watered houseplant. It amused Obinze that Nigel had decided to move to Nigeria, instead of simply visiting whenever Obinze needed to present his white general manager. The money was good. Nigel could now live the kind of life in Essex that he would never have imagined before, but he wanted to live in Lagos, at least for a while. And so Obinze's gleeful waiting commenced, for Nigel to weary of pepper soup and nightclubs and drinking at the shacks in Kuramo Beach. But Nigel was staying put, in his flat in Ikoyi, with a live-in house help and his dog. He no longer said, "Lagos has got so much flavour." And he complained more about the traffic, and he had finally stopped moping about his last girlfriend, a girl from Benue, with a pretty face and dissembling manner, who had left him for a wealthy Lebanese businessman. "The bloke's completely bald," Nigel had told Obinze. "The problem with you, my friend, is you love too easily and too much. Anybody could see the girl was a fake, looking for the next bigger thing," Obinze told him. "Don't say bigger thing like that, mate," Nigel said. Now he had met Ulrika, a lean, angular-faced woman with the body of a young man who worked at an embassy and seemed determined to sulk her way through her Nigerian posting. At dinner, she wiped her cutlery with a napkin before she began eating. "You don't do that in your country, do you?" Obinze asked coldly. Nigel darted a startled glance at him. "Actually, I do," Ulrika said, squarely meeting his gaze. Gosi patted his thigh under the table as though to calm him down, which irritated him. Nigel, too, was irritating him, suddenly talking about the townhouses Obinze was planning to build, how exciting the new architect's design was. A timid attempt to end Obinze's conversation with Ulrika. "Fantastic plan inside. Made me think of some of those pictures of fancy lofts in New York," Nigel said. "Nigel, I'm not using that plan. An open kitchen plan will never work for Nigerians, and we are targeting Nigerians because we are selling, not renting. Open kitchen plans are for expats, and expats don't buy property here." He had already told Nigel many times that Nigerian cooking was not cosmetic, with all that pounding. It was sweaty and spicy, and Nigerians preferred to present the final product, not the process.
"No more work talk," Kosi said brightly. "Ulrika, have you tried any Nigerian food?"
Obinze got up abruptly and went into the bathroom. He called Ifemelu and felt himself getting enraged when she still did not pick up. He blamed her. He blamed her for making him a person who was not entirely in control of what he was feeling. Nigel came into the bathroom.
"What's wrong, mate?"
Nigel's cheeks were bright red, as they always were when he drank. Obinze stood by the sink holding his phone, that drained lassitude spreading over him. He wanted to tell Nigel. Nigel was perhaps the only friend he fully trusted, but Nigel fancied Kosi. "She's all woman, mate," Nigel had said to him once, and he saw in Nigel's eyes the tender and crushed longing of a man for that which was forever unattainable. Nigel would listen to him, but Nigel would not understand.
"Sorry, I shouldn't have been rude to Ulrika," Obinze said. "I'm just tired. I think I'm coming down with malaria."
That night, Kosi sidled close to him in offering. It was not a statement of desire, her caressing his chest and reaching down to take his penis in her hand, but a votive offering. A few months ago, she had said she wanted to start seriously trying for our son. She did not say, "trying for our second child." She said, "trying for our son." And it was the kind of thing she learned in her church.
"There is power in this spoken word. Claim your miracle."
He remembered how months into trying to get pregnant the first time, she began to say with sulky righteousness, "All my friends who live very rough lives are pregnant." After Buki was born, he had agreed to a Thanksgiving service at Kosi's church. A crowded hall full of lavishly dressed people, people who were Kosi's friends, Kosi's kind. And he had thought of them as a sea of simple brutes, clapping, swaying simple brutes, all of them accepting and pliant before the pastor in his designer suit.
"What's wrong, darling?" Kosi asked, when he remained limp in her hand. "Are you feeling well?"
"Just tired."
Her hair was covered in a black hairnet, her face coated in a cream that smelled of peppermint, which he had always liked. He turned away from her. He had been turning away since the day he first kissed Ifemelu. He should not compare, but he did. Ifemelu demanded of him,
"No, don't come yet. I'll kill you if you come," she would say, or, "No, baby, don't move."
Then she would dig into his chest and move at her own rhythm, and finally she arched her back and let out a sharp cry.
He felt accomplished to have satisfied her. She expected to be satisfied, but Cosi did not. Cosi always met his touch with complacence, and sometimes he would imagine her pastor telling her that a wife should have sex with her husband, even if she didn't feel like it, otherwise the husband would find solace in a Jezebel. "I hope you're not getting sick," she said.
"I'm okay."
Ordinarily he would hold her, slowly rub her back until she fell asleep, but he could not get himself to do so now. So many times in the past weeks he had started to tell her about Ifemelu, but had stopped. What would he say? It would sound like something from a silly film.
"I am in love with another woman. There's someone else. I'm leaving you."
That these were words that anybody could say seriously, outside a film and outside the pages of a book, seemed odd. Cosi was wrapping her arms around him. He eased away and mumbled something about his stomach being upset, and went into the toilet. She had put a new potpourri, a mix of dried leaves and seeds, in a purple bowl, on the cover of the toilet tank. The too strong lavender scent choked him. He emptied the bowl into the toilet, and then instantly felt remorseful. She had meant well. She did not know that the too strong scent of lavender would be unappealing to him, after all. The first time he saw Ifemelu at Jazz Hall, he had come home and told Cosi.
"Ifemelu is in town. I had a drink with her."
And Cosi had said, "Oh, your girlfriend in university," with an indifference so indifferent that he did not entirely trust it. Why had he told her? Perhaps because he had sensed even then the force of what he felt, and he wanted to prepare her, to tell her in stages. But how could she not see that he had changed? How could she not see it on his face? In how much time he spent alone in his study, and in how often he went out, how late he stayed. He had hoped, selfishly, that it might alienate her, provoke her. But she always nodded, glib and accepting nods, when he told her he had been at the club or at Okudiba's. Once he said that he was still chasing the difficult deal with the new Arab owners of Megatel, and he had said "the deal" casually, as if she already knew about it, and she made vague, encouraging sounds, but he was not even involved at all with Megatel. The next morning, he woke up unrested, his mind furred with a great sadness. Cosi was already up and bathed, sitting in front of her dressing table, which was full of creams and potions, so carefully arranged that he sometimes imagined putting his hands under the table and overturning it, just to see how all those bottles would fare.
"You haven't made me eggs in a while, Vized," she said, coming over to kiss him when she saw that he was awake.
And so he made her eggs, and played with Buki in the living room downstairs, and after Buki fell asleep, he read the newspapers, all the time his head furred with that sadness. Ifemelu was still not taking his calls. He went upstairs to the bedroom. Cosi was cleaning out a closet. A pile of shoes, high heels sticking up, lay on the floor. He stood by the door and said quietly,
"I'm not happy, Cosi. I love somebody else. I want a divorce. I will make sure you and Buki lack nothing."
"What?" She turned from the mirror to look at him blankly.
"I'm not happy."
It was not how he had planned to say it, but he had not even planned what to say.
"I'm in love with somebody. I will make sure..."
She raised her hand, her open palm facing him, to make him stop talking. "Say no more," her hand said. "Say no more." And it irked him that she did not want to know more. Her palm was pale, almost diaphanous, and he could see the greenish crisscross of her veins. She lowered her hand. Then slowly, she sank to her knees. It was an easy descent for her, sinking to her knees, because she did that often when she prayed, in the TV room upstairs, with the house help and nanny, and whoever else was staying with them.
"Buki, shh," she would say in between the words of prayer,
while Buki would continue her toddler talk. But at the end, Buki always squeaked in a high, piping voice,
"Amen."
When Buki said "Amen" with that delight, that gusto, Obinze feared she would grow up to be a woman who, with that word "Amen," would squash the questions she wanted to ask of the world. And now Cosi was sinking to her knees before him, and he did not want to comprehend what she was doing. Obinze, this is a family, Kosi said. We have a child. She needs you. I need you. We have to keep this family together. She was kneeling and begging him not to leave, and he wished she would be furious instead.
Kosi, I love another woman. I hate to hurt you like this and...
It's not about another woman, Obinze, Kosi said, rising to her feet, her voice steeling, her eyes hardening. It's about keeping this family together. You took a vow before God. I took a vow before God. I am a good wife. We have a marriage. Do you think you can just destroy this family because your old girlfriend came into town? Do you know what it means to be a responsible father? You have a responsibility to that child downstairs. What you do today can ruin her life and make her damaged until the day she dies. And not because your old girlfriend came back from America? Because you have had acrobatic sex that reminded you of your time in university?
Obinze backed away. So she knew. He left and went into his study and locked the door. He loathed Kosi for knowing all this time and pretending she didn't know, and for the sludge of humiliation it left in his stomach. He had been keeping a secret that was not even a secret. A multi-layered guilt weighed him down. Guilt not only for wanting to leave Kosi, but for having married her at all. He could not first marry her, knowing very well that he should not have done so, and now, with a child, want to leave her. She was determined to remain married, and it was the least he owed her, to remain married. Panic lanced through him at the thought of remaining married, without Ifemelu. The future loomed as an endless, joyless tedium. Then he told himself that he was being silly and dramatic. He had to think of his daughter. Yet, as he sat on his chair and swiveled to look for a book on the shelf, he felt himself already in flight. Because he had retreated to his study and slept on the couch there, because they had said nothing else to each other, he thought Kosi would not want to go to his friend Ahmed's child's christening party the next day. But in the morning, Kosi laid out on their bed her blue lace long skirt, his blue Senegalese kaftan, and in between, Buki's flancy blue velvet dress. She had never done that before, laid out colour-coordinated outfits for them all. Downstairs he saw that she had made pancakes, the thick ones he liked, set out on the breakfast table. Buki had spilled some Ovaltine on her table mat.
Hezekiah has been calling me,
Kosi said musingly, about his cousin in Oka, who called only when he wanted money.
He sent a text to say he can't reach you. I don't know why he pretends not to know that you ignore his calls.
It was an odd thing for her to say, talking about Hezekiah's pretense while immersed in pretense herself. She was putting cubes of fresh pineapple on his plate, as if the previous night had never happened.
But you should do something for him, no matter how small, otherwise he will not leave you alone, she said.
Do something for him meant give him money, and Obinze, all of a sudden, hated that tendency of Igbo people to resort to euphemism whenever they spoke of money, to indirect references, to gesturing instead of pointing. Find something for this person, do something for that person. It riled him. It seemed cowardly, especially for a people who otherwise were blisteringly direct.
Fucking coward, Ifemelu had called him.
There was something cowardly even in his texting and calling her, knowing she would not respond. He could have gone over to her flat and knocked on her door, even if only to have her ask him to leave. And there was something cowardly in his not telling Kosi again that he wanted a divorce, in his leaning back into the ease of Kosi's denial. Kosi took a piece of pineapple from his plate and ate it. She was unfaltering, single-minded, calm.
Hold Daddy's hand,
she told Buki as they walked into Ahmed's festive compound that afternoon. She wanted to will normalcy back. She wanted to will a good marriage into being. She was carrying a present wrapped in silver paper for Ahmed's baby. In the car she had told him what it was, but already he had forgotten. Canopies and buffet tables dotted the massive compound, which was green and landscaped, with the promise of a swimming pool in the back. A live band was playing. Two clowns were running around, children dancing and shrieking.
They are using the same band we used for Buki's party,
Kosi whispered. She had wanted a big party to celebrate Buki's birth, and he had floated through that day, a bubble of air between him and the party. When the MC said,